Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Pillowcase sized bag of mushrooms. You. The knowledge of the cypher
is to enlighten you. Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 143, a talk with Eli and the Grouch. Eli Nockowitz and Corey Scoffern, a.k.a. the Grouch, are rappers best known for their affiliation with the Living Legends crew. The group, which also included our episode 107 guest MERS, were pioneers in the independent West Coast rap scene of the 1990s. Eli began his career with MERS and fellow Future Living Legend member Scarab in a group called Three Melancholy Gypsies while still a teenager in the Bay Area. That crew joined with another group called Mystic Journeymen, picked up a few members including the Grouch, and formed the Living Legends. Their lo-fi albums, made initially on four tracks, plus their self-booked international tours, set a template that independent rappers follow to this day. Eli and the Grouch began releasing music as a duo in 1998, and have released a number of albums together, most recently 2014's triple album, The Tortoise and the Crow. Together, separately, and with the rest of the Living Legends, their sprawling discography is one of the finest of the era. We talked with Eli and the Grouch via Skype in a call that spread out to the furthest points in the country. Us in New York, Eli in California, and the Grouch in Maui. If you enjoyed The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for instance, you should check out our talk with another independent West Coast pioneer, Paris, on episode 136. Speaking of our archive, if you want us to add to it by making new episodes, visit patreon.com/thecyphershow and become a patron. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter to keep track of everything that's going on with us. And now, here are two real living legends, Eli and the Grouch. In sort of finding out about you guys and how you met and how you started, working together, it seems like a sort of convoluted story about one of you was dating the other's cousin or cousin's friend or something.
Well, actually, it's a little more, it's different. My friend, I'm Grouch, and my friend was dating Eli's cousin. And so Eli's cousin knew that I was into hip-hop and knew that Eli was into hip-hop, and she was always trying to say, you guys should meet up, you know? And that's how it started.
And Eli was just using you for your equipment in the beginning.
Oh, you got that story, yeah. That was happening. I mean, you know, I think I was 18 and Eli was 16 or 15 at the time, and that was like a big difference to me as an 18-year-old. I was like, I don't really want to chill with this 15-year-old dude, you know. That's what I thought at first. And then his cousin hooked up the meeting, and then I met him and I was like, "Oh, he's interesting, he's cool." But he was really trying to get in on the equipment I had at my house, I felt, you know, he was just excited. He just wanted to learn the ASR. He had only used a SP1200 before that. You know, I was just wary at first, but then when he came over and he started being a cool dude and making some creative things, I was like, oh yeah, this guy's dope.
Yeah. And you even forgave him his dreadlocks.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I saw the sunsprayed video.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, little did he know that I actually, you know, like you said, my cousin was trying to hook us up, and my cousin dating his friend. So, you know, there was one of his tapes laying around, that Don't Talk to Me.
Now who cares if you signed, if you ain't in time with this shit? I'd rather hear clearly, though I'm a motherfucking misfit on a mystic ass journey to find that black stone. I practice on my mic, T-O-N-E, that spells tone, own, leave the lonely, write rhymes like these. It's crucial when
and I had heard that already, and I was like thoroughly impressed. I was like, this dude is dope. I really like this. So not only, I didn't want to just use his ASR, although I was super excited to learn how to use a sampling keyboard. I thought it was the most amazing thing ever. But I actually was like already like, dude, this, I want to make songs with this guy. This stuff is cool. And it was so different from what I was making already in L.A., with Log Cabin and all that.
Collective meditation.
When I was levitating while meditating.
Collective meditation.
Collectively collecting collectors of lectures, electing, reversing, conversing through. Constantly concerned, unconscious consciousness, conservers of art form.
Totally different spectrum.
Right, and Log Cabin was your kind of pre-Living Legends collective, right?
Yeah, you could say that for sure. It was a bunch of guys, and Merce and Scarab and I. And we were the youngsters and everybody else was older. That definitely was the first crew I was involved with.
At the time you guys met, this was 94, 95, somewhere around there?
95, I think.
Eli, was your group, the Three Melancholy Gypsies, was that active at that time? It's you, Merz, and Scarab, right?
Yeah, well, at that point, Scarab was going to school. I had dropped out of school. I was done. I was like, I want to make music. I don't want to go to school. So Scarab on one end was going to school. I was moved up to the Bay with my cousin. And Merce was going to school in Santa Cruz somewhere. And so at that point, we weren't really active. Like, I hadn't actually seen neither of the guys in a while. Everybody was doing their own thing.
The thing about the time you guys first met up, you know, early mid-90s, was not a lot of people had equipment. I was kind of amazed to find out that, you know, you guys literally knew, either personally or by name, everyone in the Bay Area who had a sampler at that time, right?
Yeah. It was, you know, someone with equipment, it was like finding a gold mine when somebody had a sampler or a keyboard or a drum machine, you know? So I had a couple, I had my radar was set for finding that stuff. And, you know, we would travel after school on buses. And I remember in high school, you know, just to go over to somebody's house, traveling, you know, a couple cities away just to be around the equipment. And it was like mesmerizing at that point for me.
Yeah, that sort of feeds into what he was saying about he was probably weary about this kid coming over like all hype on the ASR, because that's true. Like, there was equipment was so expensive back then. It's so different than what it is now. Like, anybody can really go get a copy of Fruity Loops or something and start making beats with no money or the very bare minimum, whereas back then it cost thousands of dollars to just make a beat.
Yeah, I paid $2,500 for my first sampler, my first real sampler.
Wow.
Yeah. Right. And that was like as a 17-year-old kid, you know, with no money, pretty much.
Right, that's a lot of allowances.
It was actually a credit card. I just went into debt immediately as soon as I could get a credit card. I guess it was right when I turned 18, actually, that I got that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, Grouch, you got into music kind of by blood, right? Your dad was a musician.
But I don't think that's how I got into music, really. Because he didn't really raise me. I didn't live with him. I knew that he did music, and I loved what he did, and I respected it and thought it was cool. But I kind of found my own way into music, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And part of that, I know, was through KPU, which, you know, tiny little community station in the Bay.
KPOO FM 89.5 is a San Francisco-based, independent, listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio station. They broadcast an all-rap show in 1979, the first radio station on the West Coast to do so. They were also the first station in the Bay Area to play salsa and reggae.
Why was that so important?
They would play hip-hop that they didn't play on other radio stations. I mean, they would play Too Short, they'd play KRS-One, they'd play Public Enemy, they'd play Big Daddy Kane, you know, and they'd play NWA and just cool stuff. And I was like, wow. I would go to sleep with my radio next to me on my bed, just listening to that stuff, like nonstop. I don't know. I kind of feel like it was part of, you know, it was part of being raised was listening to hip hop. You know, I feel like hip hop raised me in a sense, because that was a large part of my early childhood for sure.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, the Mystic Journeymen were kind of inspirational to you for a lot of reasons.
PSC, now known as Lucky I Am, and BFAP, now Sunspot Jones, formed the group Mystic Journeymen in 1992. Both members would eventually become part of the Living Legends crew. The group put out a bunch of self-released albums starting in 1995.
Can you lay out kind of how you first became aware of them and why their whole aesthetic, like approach to business, approach to music was so inspirational?
Well, actually, I was, you know, there was this girl at school that I used to talk hip hop with, and she's
how, that's how all great things start, by the way.
Exactly.
It is, and, honestly.
Yeah. And she put me on to the Mystic Journeymen, and she thought they were really cool. And, you know, when I met them, they were doing things like flying to Japan to do their own tours and just, you know, taking their own money and landing in other countries, showing up there unknown and creating a situation where people would fall in love with what they were doing. And they would bring that wherever they went. And it was kind of like, you know, everybody else at the time was creating demo tapes to try to get signed to a record label. And they were saying, fuck record labels. You know, what we make in our bedroom is dope already. And we don't need an A&R or some, you know, Hollywood dude to tell us it's cool. We already know it's cool. And we're going to go sell it and promote it and live it and perform it, you know, regardless of what anybody says. And I love that. And so, you know, as soon as I met them, I was kind of like Eli was when he met me, just trying to soak it up and hang around and learn what they knew. And yeah, that's how it started.
Yeah. And I know you guys, they and you, you know, started out doing a bunch of your stuff on 4-track.
Yeah.
What were some tricks that, you know, each of you used when recording stuff on 4-track to try and, you know, get more tracks on there or get stuff to sound better or whatever? Were there any like crazy tricks you used to do?
The best one was, you know, because you could take the tracks and you could record on 4 tracks, or maybe it was 3. I can't remember exactly how it went, but you could basically bounce a number of the tracks into 1 track and then free up the 3 tracks that you just bounced the information from. But you're dealing with an audio cassette tape, and it's like, you know, one eighth of an inch or 1/4 of an inch tape. And like, when you do that, it makes it sound like shit, because you can't just keep degrading and, you know, recording over things on that small of a tape. But, you know, when I was always on the search to get better sound quality. And so what we found out was that if we got a SMPTE box, like a MIDI time code box, we could bypass the step where you have to record the beat to the tape. So we had 4 tracks just for vocals, and then we could sync up the sampler with this MIDI time code. And so it would run alongside of the vocal tracks. And then when you would record your master, it would all go to a DAT tape, which was another tape. It was a digital audio tape. I don't know if that makes sense to someone who really can't imagine that style of recording.
A 4-track is a completely analog recording device that recorded to the standard audio cassettes that were common in the 80s and 90s. These 4-tracks were relatively inexpensive, and you could record 4 audio parts for simultaneous playback. For example, you might record a voice, guitar, bass, and drums each to their own track. Unfortunately, the devices were extremely difficult to run in sync with each other or other tools, which meant that for most people, it was impossible to record more than 4 tracks without having to combine them together to make room for more audio. When you combine 3 tracks onto a 4th track, the sound quality would be greatly degraded. What Grouch is describing here is basically a way of using a digital device as a musical clock to keep their sampler in time with the speed of the 4-track. This meant that the artist had four tracks to work with in addition to the sampler, instead of the two that normally would have been left over after recording from the sampler. Modern studios usually use digital systems that can record 128 or even more tracks. We even used 9 tracks just to produce this episode of the show. So effectively having 6 tracks to work with was still not very much, but way better than just 4.
You didn't have to print the beat until you got to the final stage, which was mixing the song to the DAT. That was like the biggest trick in making the best sound quality for the 4 track that we found.
Nice. Eli, anything on your end?
Well, I was just reminiscing in my head about all those old first albums for me, for us, 96 or whatever, and how they sounded.
Continue my track, despite the fucking storm. I woke up in a sweat. The words from my mother finally hit me. I've got to do something with my life, and it should be.
Now, if I listen to them, I'm like, oh my God, it's really bad. Yeah. It's really bad, but I remember back then thinking, this is amazing that we're making these sounds, and it's us, and it sounds great to us back then.
Yeah.
But it just has character that you couldn't recreate. And I know that we used to, I used to love recording at a really slow speed and then speeding it and then putting it back to normal speed and having your voice sound like chipmunks and stuff like that.
The only way out of this guy, ask me why, did he lie, Millie, tell I first.
I thought it was hilarious, like all those kind of things, and doing skits and stuff back then to try and get, you know, something original out of the 4-track. But there wasn't much you can do, man, with a 4-track. It was going to sound the way it sounded. And I know that one album in particular that I made, 4-tracks, LA and Back, if I can't even, like, I've tried to take that and put it in a digital form to give to people, sell to people now, because it's been out of print forever. But it sounds so bad, dude. Like, the crappiest crap. Like, distorted bass. I was like, what was I thinking, man? It was terrible.
Yeah, but it's fun. You know, I was listening to, I think, each of your first albums to prepare for this.
Eli's first album, released in 1996, is As They Pass. And the Grouch's 1995 debut is Don't Talk to Me.
For As They Pass, Eli, were you listening to a lot of science fiction when you were making that? Because I feel like you have that song about, like, the rich destroying the planet and fleeing to outer space.
Yeah.
Like you're mentioning Area 51 and the X-Files and all this stuff.
When the knife is to the wrist of the earth, witness the birth and death of a planet as it plummets off its axis, while the blue-collar taxes are used to fund the building of escape hatches to pilot through the ozone. To save the VIPs, I see the future because I'm a criminal.
Sound wave through your Area 51 hysteria, making no money but having fun. Catching
the future now accompanied by soldiers with a shrug of the shoulder, detecting other form with Fox Mulder, warming the stage in my mind with a strong grip on things.
Yeah, I've always been like into that genre of book, of movie. I've always been, you know, like I'm always imagining and up in my head, and I've been that way since a kid. And it's kind of funny because Grouch is kind of the opposite, not really into that kind of stuff, but I am. So that's why it was like even more interesting for us to eventually connect and become Grouch and Eli or a group, because we are really kind of different in that way. But yeah, I've always had an imaginative way of writing, I guess you can say, and I come up with stories in my head. Plus, I was a big weed head, so that just, you know, I was smoked out a lot of the time, and who, it just takes me to all kinds of crazy places in my mind. But all those little conspiracy theories back then, I used to think they were super interesting, and it was fun to write like that. It was like basically like drawing a picture or writing a story to me.
Yeah, and so when I went back to listen to that, you have the intro to it that just kind of mentions your friends in LA and in the Bay Area and stuff. And there were a lot of names, specifically people on kind of the Bay Area side, that I didn't recognize.
What's up to my man Grouch for letting me sleep on his couch? Dusty Black and PSC for rocking the show till the mics went out. The fundamentals of KS, the rest of Cyto P, Mike T and MOS possess supreme qualities. What's up to Eclipse? He rips with mic in hand. Can't forget my man Prince on the app he stands. Aesop and Axiom with some of the illest flows I've heard. Worldwide underground rock to the death of the word.
Like, who were you guys sort of hanging out with around that period
in the Bay Area? you know, there was Living Legends, there was High Road.
The Hieroglyphics Crew is a long-running underground rap collective based in Oakland. It was founded in the early 1990s by Del the Funky Homo Sapien. The current membership consists of Del, Casual, Pep Love, producer and manager Domino, DJ Torre, and the four individual members of the rap group Souls of Mischief, Festo, A+, Opio, and Tajay.
We didn't really hang with High Road too tough back then, but we really liked them. And then there was Hobo Junction.
Hobo Junction was, along with the Hyro crew, one of the first and most popular rap crews in the Bay Area. Their key player was Reggie Saphir Gibson, and the collective also included Plan B, Poke Martian, Big New, IQ, and others.
We kind of hung with them on Telegraph and sold tapes. There was a crew that we had a lot of time with was, they were called Cytoplasms, and they were made up of a whole bunch of different characters. One of the most flamboyant being Boss One, and he's done a couple projects that have come out. And who else, Eli? Eclipse 427.
There was a lot of names back then that I would literally have to listen to what you're even talking about on that intro. I think it's even funny that I did that in 96 with my first tape, where I met all those guys through Grouch and Mystic Journeyman. Like, I didn't know any of those dudes yet, and I'm already talking about like these guys, because it was such a crazy connection between all the people that were doing the underground hip hop that we were doing. It's like an instant thing. Oh, you do this, I do this, we're kind of a family. It was like, so instantly after my first tape, with just probably getting to know a couple of these guys that I named on there, I already felt like I was a part of something cool. Like, this was something different, and it felt good to feel a part of.
Yeah, because you got to imagine, hip hop is not yet the most blown up popular culture in the world. It's like when you drive down the street and you see a guy on the corner with baggy pants and a certain kind of belt on, chewing on a licorice stick, you know that he's into hip hop at that point. And you know that he's probably into the kind of hip hop that you're into. It's not like nowadays where you can't tell. Somebody with baggy pants could be into EDM or, you know, I don't know, all different types of genres of things. But it was very easy to tell who was into hip hop at the time and who was down for it and loved it and, you know, recognize the culture in it. And that's why, like he said, we had all these instant connections when we got out there and started meeting people.
Yeah. And so one or two more things about kind of the four track days before we move on to some higher fidelity stuff. You guys sold a lot of tapes hand to hand, right? Back when you were starting out, what was your best like sales pitch, best sales technique?
For me, I just talked about this the other day, to bring it back to Mystic Journeyman a bit. When I made As They Pass in Grouch's basement and just met Journeyman and everything, I was a timid, shy dude that could barely look you in the eye and talk to you rather than try and sell you something on the corner. Like, I remember being out there with my tape, like really following the big brothers. Like, they're like, do it like this, sell your stuff like this. But Sunspot was so outgoing and like, it was not scared of talking to people. Like, it was hard for me. I would just kind of like follow the big brothers. What are they doing? Let me try and do this. So the best thing that ever happened for me back then was Amoeba opening the doors to us saying, come sell your tapes in here.
Amoeba is a well-known independent chain of music stores with locations in Berkeley, San Francisco, and Hollywood.
That way, I didn't have to like sell hand-to-hand because it was really hard for me, except a little bit later when we started having shows where people came specifically to see us and buy our albums, it was easier because they just came to me. I didn't have to sell anything. But for me, like a sales pitch back then was like, look at this cool artwork I did. I think you should buy this because it's really cool. Like, I don't know. Who knows what I was saying back then?
I don't know, but we got pretty good at it. I know I did. And I know that in the beginning, what Eli's saying is true. You know, it was also a different time then. So people were really open to seeing what we had. And, you know, oh, you guys are creative and you're making something in your home and you're out here on the street selling it. Like, that wasn't, people weren't doing that all over the place. Nowadays, if you get somebody trying to sell you their CD on the corner, you're like, dude, give me some space, man. You know, like, I don't want to buy your CD usually. And that's kind of sad. I mean, but I think that it's like that for people now, just because it's been done so many times and people have been burned so many times and bought something that is not that cool, that it's not, you know, it's not that easy to sell music like that anymore, I don't think. But when we were doing it in the Bay Area, at least, it was, you know, we would gather on the corner and it'd be like a fun, it would be like a fun day of going to work, you know, and we'd meet out there and there'd be characters from Hobo Junction standing on the same corner as us. And then you'd have the Quantum guys coming down the street and they, and I remember Lyrics Born seeing us selling our tapes and just being like, whoa, you guys are selling your tapes out here on the street. And, you know, he, like, first time I met him was on the street on Telegraph and he was like, oh, play me this tape. And I played him the tape. He's like, oh, that's cool, man, you know. And then word just kind of spreads that, like, if you want some hip-hop music, some independent stuff, go down to Telegraph on the weekend and, you know, you could find some guys out there slanging this stuff. And so people, you know, there started to be a following for it and people would come just to, you know, come to the Avenue just to buy the music. And then, like, yeah, as we got more comfortable, it, I mean, Sunspot always had kind of like, motherfucker, check out this tape. You know, anybody walking by, it was like, yo, you got this new Mystic Journeyman shit yet? You know, and people be like, no, what's that? He was like, oh, you need to buy this, you know, get over here and listen to this, buy it, $5, you know? And so we had that kind of attitude at a point that we actually used to say that we were punking people into buying our music. You know, at some point, just by being so rah-rah about it, like, motherfucker, you gotta have this, you know? And then people would pull out $5 and be like, you're right, you know?
Yeah. So your early sort of overseas tours with the crew, is it true you guys would actually show up in different countries without having booked anything?
Most definitely.
How did that work?
We would take our tape sale money because that's how we were making our cash. And as soon as, like, you know, as soon as the tape sale dollars would add up to enough to buy an airline ticket, we would go over to, man, I forgot the name of the, there was like a travel agency right there in Berkeley for the students. And they had like the best deals. And as soon as we got enough money, we would go there and buy tickets to Europe or to Japan. That's where we were going at the time, either England or Germany or Japan. That's where we would buy the round trip ticket to. And it was kind of like whoever had tape sale money ready to go around the same time, that's who was going on the trip. So there was a couple times when I went with Mystic Journeyman, me, Merce, and Picasso or something. And then there was times I went with Eli, Scarab, Mystic Journeyman. And like, we would just go out in different formations depending on who had their shit together. And then we would get out there. And granted, Journeyman had gone a couple times. So they always had a few leads. Like, you know, last time we were out here, we met up with this certain DJ and this certain MC. So we're going to check them out again. But then there was a lot of the trip was always unplanned and let's just see what we can fall into. And so we would get places like Amsterdam and there would be a big Far Side show that night and we would just show up at it. And then Tom, you know, lucky I am from Mystic Journeyman would say, yeah, I knew Imani back growing up in LA. So let me go holler at him and see if they'll let us get on the show. And, you know, and sometimes it would happen and sometimes it wouldn't. And even if it wouldn't, we'd still maybe do a freestyle outside in front of the show and sell tapes and, you know, get on like that. And we would travel around and do that on many occasions.
Crazy. And so it seems like at a certain point you guys all end up in LA, but from what I understand, it wasn't like a group decision. You didn't like take a vote and say, okay, we're going to all go to Los Angeles. Like how did that happen?
Well, I know that, was it you first, Grouse, or was it Lucky first? No, it was you, right?
Well, I know for me, well, we were successful in the Bay Area and we kept throwing these shows at the Maritime Hall and there was like 2,200 people who would repeatedly come to the shows. And we were like, we need to do this same thing in Los Angeles that we're doing up here in the Bay Area. And that was part of the motivation. And I know that I also, when I moved to LA, I had just gotten together with my girlfriend at the time who became my wife, and she wanted to move to LA. And I just remember that everybody started going around the same time, but it wasn't like we're all gonna, you know, hey, everybody, if you want to be in the group, we all got to move to LA and pursue this, you know?
Yeah, that's what it was. Cause I lived with Grouch at the time. And when he was like, dude, I'm about to move to LA with his lady, I was like, well, shit, like that's my boy and that's my roommate. And I don't want to live with anybody else that I know out here. I was like, I might as well go home then. Cause that's home to me. I had been in the Bay at that point 5 years and I was ready to go back home too. So I used that, him moving out and Lucky at the same time was like, I'm going to go back to LA too. And I think Merce was already back, if not in Arizona or something at that point. I was like, everybody's moving. I'm not staying here. I was ready to go back. And so, yeah, at that point, everybody kind of just started migrating west.
it just made sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then once you get there, there's, you know, the weekly shows at the Good Life become super important.
The Good Life Cafe was a health food market and cafe in Los Angeles, known for its open mic nights that helped the 1990s Los Angeles alternative hip hop movement flourish. Their Thursday night open mic event began in 1989 and lasted until 1997. Good Life regulars included Freestyle Fellowship, Pigeon John, Abstract Root, Volume 10, members of the Jurassic 5, and many more. More established acts like The Far Side, Fat Joe, and Biz Markie would occasionally perform as well. Selma director Ava DuVernay, herself a frequent performer at The Good Life with her group Figures of Speech, directed a 2008 documentary about the venue and its associated scene called This Is the Life.
What were those events like? Like, who would be there both performing and in the audience? Like, what were those weekly nights like?
Time periods off a little bit.
Time periods wrong?
Yeah,
okay.
Because it's for The Good Life, for me, that was a big moment for me as being really young. I was probably one of the first places that I got up on a stage in front of a bunch of people I didn't know and rapped. And I had done it at school at that point. I was 14 or 15, just turned 15. And I went to The Good Life with Scarab and we got on the stage. And that was the first time I rapped in front of people that didn't know me. And it was a big deal. Plus I was super, super influenced and loved the Freestyle Fellowship. And that, you know, they came out of The Good Life. And so me and Scarab would go there when we were really young and just be mesmerized and amazed by the quality of rapper that was going on there. So that was like way before I even went to the Bay Area. So by the time we came back to LA, it was Project Blowed. Good Life was no longer.
Project Blowed, which grew out of the scene at the Good Life, is an open mic event in Los Angeles that began in 1994. It is also the name for the overarching crew involved in that scene and the record label they formed. Some key members over the years have been AC Alone, Abstract Root, Medusa, Micah 9, No Can Do, Bus Driver, and tons more. Project Blowed has also expanded to Las Vegas, Austin, and the Inland Empire.
And AC Alone and Ab Root and a bunch of other guys started Project Blowed. So that was fully functioning. And I know, like, when I think back, I feel like I only performed at the Project Blowed maybe twice or three times. And the coolest time was Grouch and I. It was a G&E show for like No More Greener Grasses time. And it was packed in there and we rocked it. And And it was a good feeling because I didn't know, you know, it, you never know where what the vibe could be at Project Blood when you're an outsider coming in. Even though we had ties to the to different people, you know, you never know. Like, could be a lot of youngsters looking at you like, who are these guys? But it was like a lot of love. And that was like, you know, solidified our connection with all those guys. And which is still going to this day.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to get into a little bit about you guys forming a duo, because you kind of came out of this larger collective. Your styles, and you've talked about this a lot, how your styles really complement each other, right? Low voice and higher pitched voice, faster style and slower style, stuff like that.
Looking at the TV, searching for something to take my mind off the muck in the mind. They fucking the fire, pissing gasoline. I mean, the demeanors, remus and beamers, the hatred they're taking in. Hurry it out the door. Ushering on the new millennium. It's on again, we killing it. It's on again, we feeling the body full of bullet holes. It's on. Did you get the bulletin or not?
This world is twisted. You missed it. The whole point of life resisted. Love, how you gonna shed all that blood? How they gonna bet on that? You rather break the bank than focus your mind, have to think, scared of silence.
Are those things you kind of developed against each other, like in contrast to each other? Oh, he's like this, so let me make sure I'm a little more like this, or was that a little more organic?
That was definitely more organic. He was already, by the time I met him, he was him. And it was the same for me. Like, I had my influences in the way I like to rap, and he had his way, and that's what, you know, creatively attracted ourselves to each other. It's like somebody doing something different is like, man, that's, I really like that. I can't rap like that, but I appreciate that you can. It would just happen to be contrasting.
Right. And it seems like between like your first and second and then the second and third group albums, there's a pretty big leap. No More Greener Grasses had a pretty big range, like a bigger range musically than your first album. What do you think accounts for that? Were you guys growing as producers? What was going on to make the big leap musically happen there?
It's just like anything that is somebody's craft, like you continuously do something that you love, you're going to get better just naturally. You're going to learn how to mix better. You're going to learn what sounds that you use are actually better sounding sounds. And so I would expect and hope that through each project that we've made separately or together, that the sound would get better and bigger and different and always changing. So it makes total sense that we jump from G&E Volume 1 to just No More Greener Grasses. Plus our equipment changed. Everything was changing. Like, mm-hmm. technologies that we were using to record were changing. Our better mics, better learning how to mix on our own, no more distorted bass. You know what I mean? Like, we started getting it more.
Yeah. And then by the time of the third album, you guys are adding singers and things like that.
Sprung and empty-handed, but my jet landed and life expanded. I'm twice the man. It's like my plan. It just might vanish if I can't stand it.
What was kind of behind that, really bringing in people to sing on hooks, which you did a bunch on say G&E?
Well, what was behind that?
Just trying to add more musicality to the songs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and involve other people and, you know, break up just raps, you know, so it's not just rap. I don't know. Try different things.
Right. Just try wanting to try different things and not do the same thing over and over. And I guess you can equate that to us expanding the way we look at our music. Like, we can do more than what we're doing. We could bring in whoever we want. And just having a singer on a chorus back then on some independent underground stuff was different.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I think people forget, that was not very common at all in the underground.
Right.
No.
You know, at the time you guys started doing it.
Right. I never even thought about that, but that's true.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask something about tempos, because I was inspired by Grouch. You have that, you know, on So Complicated. You say, like, was it 87 is one of my tempos?
Yeah, yeah.
Now 87 is one of my tempos. You could throw me a curve, though. I ain't no simp. Broken riding the beat since my talent was local. Bay bread, buddy, before I switch it to SoCal.
Why is that range, you know, so comfortable for you guys? And what kind of stuff do you think about if you end up with a track that's dramatically slower or faster than your comfort zone?
Yeah, I just don't like, I don't like to force myself to rap over certain tempos, and those are just, you know, 85, 87, 89, 88, you know, even like 93s, those are all super comfortable and just natural for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know, that's where that line comes from. And, you know, I rap on faster ones and slower ones, but it's more of a challenge. And sometimes I enjoy the challenge, but if I don't do well on it, or if I listen back later on and I don't like the verse as much as, you know, some of my regular like laid back stuff, which is the case sometimes, then I feel like, you know, even though it's a challenge, it doesn't, you know, it's not necessarily better for me to challenge myself in that way.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't like the end result, you know? So it's basically like, you know, sticking with what I know and what works for me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I'm always open to experiment. It's just, you'll get a line like that out of me because that's my real shit that I'm comfortable with.
Yeah. And Eli, you know, on the solo album tip, you took a little bit of a break. I mean, you were doing stuff, you had instrumental albums, you had group albums, but as far as solo records, there was a little break between like 99 and then when Poltergeist came out in 2003. And it seems like when that record came out, you know, your sound, your subject matter kind of switched up a little bit. When you think about it now, what kind of changes do you hear, you know, going into Poltergeist from that and the record before?
Oh my gosh. Well, when Poltergeist, when I made that, and the time that was made, we were back in LA. I know that Grouch and his lady had found an apartment. They were settled. I was not settled. I was still at my mom's house looking for my first apartment by myself because I'd never lived by myself. So I found an apartment. I had my first spot. I think I had a little bucket car that I finally got on my own. So I was starting to like be on my own and have my own money and blowing my own money and doing stupid stuff. And at that point, I moved from just smoking weed and drinking to popping pills and painkillers, and stuff started going in a bad direction in that part of my life too. So the subject matter was drastically changing at that point.
Why am I here on this planet? I know it deals with the bad music. Lift off, use its potential. Stencil out my life like a graph. Not the way I plan out the future. Got to get my love, make it last.
I was with a girl that became my fiance. I was going to get married. I was 22 or something. 23, 22. I was young, man. I remember what it was really with Poltergeist is, I think Grouch did something similar where we, for the first time, we paid a bunch of money. I paid like almost 10 G's to mix and master that album in a big expensive studio in LA. So, so that was a big momentous thing. I was like, man, I'm going to take this album. I want it to sound the best of anything I've ever made. And at that point, it was to me like it was a big deal. Subject matter was towards the end of the album started getting maybe a little darker and moodier.
I fall in a winding spiral upwards. Catch me calling out your name, talking to ghostly voices, mostly living in shame, searching memories, looking for enemies, breaking down your frame. Unconscious body charging the battery, sleeping open to whispers through the cracks and passing flames. I can't control it when they speak because I'm falling. Can't call it when I'm fast asleep. Once you make your mind.
And I remember the studio that I was recording in was a little rental spot that I paid some little amount a month for, this little box of a room with no windows. And I would sit in there and hotbox that room and make this music. And I felt like I was super in the zone, and I could feel the feeling of that room still. Like it was an interesting time, man. It really was.
You know, around that time, around 03, you know, I know you guys did a lot of, around that period, a lot of tours with Living Legends, and it seems kind of like you know, speaking of substances and stuff, like all eight of you, it seems like we're drinking pretty crazily, and maybe some of you, like you hinted, delving into other stuff at that point as well.
Yeah.
How did that keep going, and like how did that eventually end? I, you know, obviously all eight of you still aren't on a bus drinking every day. Like, what kind of ended that period?
Well, I know for me, I can't speak for any of the other guys, but we were definitely at a peak of like being on those buses and having reasonable success at that point. We were just, you know, young and really just wilding out, man, just acting crazy. And for me, though, I, you know, me being an addict, which I believe I am and will always be, I didn't know when to stop. Like, I got to a level that I just kept going, and anything you gave me, I liked it. And I found my drugs of choice, and they were really taking me to a place I didn't want to be anymore. So on a personal journey, I was like, I got to quit. I got to stop. I need help. And I went in that direction. And now, of course, I've been clean for 10 years from all that stuff. But I know that at one point, you know, we were playing around with death. It was crazy. We were just acting out of our minds for a while. But, you know, I think everybody personally came to their own spots with that stuff. And everybody went in kind of different directions in that way.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't Tommy play a role in yours or no?
Yeah, Lucky knew another guy that was like an underground cat from a different LA crew that had a serious drug problem. And he had received help from an organization called Music Cares to get into a rehab because, you know, just trying. I remember at that point I was looking for rehabs. Like, I want to get clean. I need help. And these people, I would call these places and they would be like, yeah, it's $30,000 for 30 days and it's upfront. And I'm like, what the hell? I'm like, how am I supposed to do that? Like, if you're not Brad Pitt or like somebody, a movie star or huge Lenny Kravitz or something, how do you do that? Like, so I was pretty distraught. I was like, I can't do this by myself. I tried. And so I remember Lucky telling me about somebody getting into rehab for free or getting it paid for. So I did. When I was ready, I literally hit up Lucky. I'm like, dude, can you hit up your boy? And I'm ready to go. And he said, I'll call you back. And then somebody called me back, said, we got a bed for you at this rehab in the Valley. Are you ready to go? And I'm like, I'm ready to go. And that was it for me.
Wow. And Grouch, you know, there's kind of a thing about kind of growing up and maturing in a different way with you, which is, I know your music took a little bit of a turn in terms of like subject matter and stuff when your wife got pregnant. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I'll tell you, my story is different, but I was getting drunk 56 nights in a row on 56 night tours. That's the last one I remember. And it was like, I remember it was 56 dates and we were drinking Hennessy and Patron and whatever else, beers and anything else that we had on the bus. Every night we had a huge bottle of Hennessy and a huge Patron and we're finishing them plus drinking other things. And I was, you know, falling down drunk every single night. And then I would take the whole day, the next day, to like just lay in my bunk on the bus and drink as much water as I could so that I could recuperate enough to start it again the next day. And that to me was just, at the time, it was, you know, when I was getting drunk, it was fun. And then, you know, afterwards, it was just like, this is hell. You know, what am I doing? And, you know, we would get, you know, we would have the parties on the bus with the girls and everything. And I got in trouble with my girlfriend at the time. Actually, she was my wife at the time. I got in trouble with my wife about that. And I almost lost her. And this was before we had our daughter. And I was like, I'm going to die if I stay on this, in this life, in this lifestyle. I'm, you know, it leads to death. I wasn't near death, but it's like, where does this go? It's not sustainable.
Right.
So I was like, fuck that. I want to try to save what I have with this woman and I want to go the other way, because this is not how I started. You know, I never used to drink to do shows, and it had gotten to a point where it's like I had to drink in order to perform the show. And so at that point, I was just like, I'm not going to be this guy. And I made a decision that I'm not going to be this guy. I remember my first sober show. I remember making it a thing and deciding, you know, it wasn't cool to be sober in the scene. I mean, it wasn't uncool, but it wasn't like cool. And I wanted to, I remember using it as damn near a gimmick, to be honest, but also, I mean, not really a gimmick, but like, you know, coming on stage and saying, I'm not drinking tonight. I'm sober, and trying to make that be cool to the crowd that I was rapping to. And that, you know, I would get cheers for that. And the crowd would give me love for that just because of the way I was presenting it. Even if they were drunk, they would be like, yeah, you know? And so,
yeah.
And so I would take that and I would use it as power to do the next one. And I would just build them up show after show after show. And in my head, I'd be like, oh, I'm 7 shows sober. I'm 8 shows sober. I'm 11 shows sober. And that gave me the power to just drop that habit. Now, I didn't take it as far as Eli. I'm not completely clean. I can drink a beer and I can drink wine with dinner, and I don't have a problem with alcohol anymore. I don't drink that much, maybe twice a month, you know, and I don't get anywhere near as, I don't get drunk like that. And I don't know. I just made that decision that I wasn't going to go that route anymore. And it just started to change everything in my life. It changed the crowd that we were rapping to, you know, because we had gotten so sloppy that the crowd was sloppy and the crowd was drunk and obnoxious and in my face after the show saying, oh, man, listen to this, you know, and it was annoying and it was stinky. And I was like, fuck this, you know, I don't want to attract this kind of energy anymore. And so, you know, started going back to where I came from and doing songs like Remember Who You Are.
My baby's 5 months growing in the womb. There's a population boom going on. There's a planetary shift, you can hear it in this song. They try to heal it, then cut it. Heal it, then cut it. Heal it, then cut it. Don't cut it again. If you feel it, then love it. If you feel it, then love it. If you feel it, love it, my friend. It's right in front of us.
And trying to remember who I was and trying to come back to, you know, the morals and the values that were real to me before I even got into music.
Yeah. So that actually brings me to stuff about each of your families that I wanted to talk to you about. Grouch, you know, in your song Emotion, the first verse, I think, is about your grandmother and her lifelong battles with mental illness and kind of her long-term institutionalization.
The way she lived was just a little bit different now. Call her crazy, diagnosed schizophrenic. Wow, she was a patient at a hospital for most of life. And when she wasn't, she was fucking with somebody's life. She used to lock my mom in the basement for no reason. The same basement we made beats in and peace in. If that's all.
How, did your family hear that song? Like, if they did, what did they think?
Oh yeah, I think my mom cried when she heard that song. I don't know if everybody else has heard that song. I mean, my grandmother had passed away, so she didn't hear that song. But yeah, I mean, my mother, I can't remember exactly what the reaction was, but she loves all my music, and she was very touched by that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who else in my family. I mean, you know, no one has really talked to me so much specifically about that song.
Mm-hmm.
But either that or I forgot, you know, maybe at the time.
Yeah, and Eli, actually, speaking of mothers, in 2009, you did a whole album with your mother.
Yeah.
That was a very, like, country and folk-influenced record.
Coming round sometime soon. Oh, poet man. Streaks of colors light the sky.
And the thing that grabbed me about that was you have that song Safe on it with Slug. That's like the first verse is, I assume, you rapping about your mom debating whether or not to have you in first person in her voice. Seven digits and the whole deal's fixed quick, but you froze cold and you feel sick. You looked at your angel again. You slowly put the phone back on its hinge. You lie down right next to my big brother. You try not to cry when you got undercover. You had no money. Had no, you know, was that hard to write, knowing that, like, not only was she going to hear it, but literally she was going to sing on it?
That was actually Pigeon John doing that.
Oh,
and
okay.
I remember when he wrote that and gave it to me for the song, I was like, whoa, this is really one of the most personal verses I've heard from John, talking about his mother, exactly what you're saying, debating whether to keep him when she found out she was pregnant and all that stuff. So I was very moved by that. And that whole project, man, is just very special to me. And during that time, I think it was Grouch Stole Christmas, like the first one or second one, where that album came out during that time. So I was able to go out with Grouch on that tour and bring my mom for a couple weeks on the road. And she would come up and do two or three songs every night. And she had so much fun. And she never got to do music for a living like I did. Mm-hmm. So she always ended up taking care of us and working a 9-to-5. So for her to be on the road just for that little amount of time and experience the love that our crowd was giving her and still give her meant everything to her, means everything to her still. So it was a very cool thing that I got to do with her. I'm always be grateful that I got to do that.
And so she played a lot while you were growing up around the house or out ever?
Yeah, she was a, I always bring it back to her because she used to play so much music in the house. She always had big speakers in our house that on Saturday and Sunday would be blasting. She used to play stuff really loud and from, you know, a lot of folk stuff to rock to, you know, Bob Marley to Michael Jackson, Bob Dylan, every kind of, you know, spanning all over the place. And so I was instantly just in love with music. She bought me one of those Fisher-Price record players, plastic record mm-hmm. players that I wish I still had. It was so cool. Just as a, you know, 3 years old, I had one of those, 4 years old. So I always definitely give my mom credit for my love of music. And she would sing. She was very politically active even when we were young, and she sang at a lot of demonstrations in LA where, you know, it'd be a protest or something where they have singers come with a guitar and get on the mic and sing some political songs. And I would be hanging on to her leg while she was singing in front of all these people and just, you know, I was right there on the stage with her from the get. So she's definitely a big influence on me.
Wow. And, Eli, one thing about the song ANX that you did really, really grabbed me, knowing a lot of people with, you know, anxiety and panic disorders and stuff.
Most friends can't comprehend your plight, which isolates me further inward to make a harder fight. I swing my right hand to my left, trying to catch my sanity and my breath. Sometimes I can't stand to be me. That's just a fact. ANX, my anthrax, and yet a blessing in disguise to help me open up my inner eyes.
How was that to write? Was it tough to put that, to put that out in public?
No, not at all. I don't know what it is, but writing is always very therapeutic, number one. Some people write in their journals if they're not musicians, or they just write to get stuff out. So writing that song at that time when I was really dealing with anxiety a lot and sort of still figuring out, what does it mean? What is it? Where does it come from? What can I do to avoid it or get through it? And so being able to write that song was freeing for me. And I realized when I started really dealing with anxiety, when the more I talked about it, the better I felt. And the more I realized that I am so not alone and that so many people deal with these feelings. And some people have been dealing with them since they were kids. And it's really a messed up, difficult situation for a lot of people. It's really hard stuff. So it was not hard at all to talk about it because I knew some people would identify. And every time we do that song, people have these looks on their faces like, thank you for saying that. Just saying it out loud, even if somebody doesn't say anything to you, it makes people feel better knowing that you are not alone in those feelings.
Yeah. And, you know, Grouch, I want to ask about, you know, something that not many people often talk to you about, which is the production side of what you do. You did one of our show's producers' favorites, the first Felt album, right?
Yes.
I'm not a player, I throw up a lot.
I know. That's so.
The wicked walk amongst us, and you don't know me that well. Probably shouldn't trust the story I tell, but I'm a speaking.
Felt is a side project or supergroup, depending on your perspective, made up of Slug from Atmosphere and Murs, former Cypher guest and, of course, member of the Living Legends. Their first album, 2002's Felt, a tribute to Christina Ricci, was indeed produced entirely by the Grouch. Slug and Murs dedicated the album to Ricci because when the two first met, they were both working on songs about her. Their second album, Felt Volume 2, a tribute to Lisa Bonet, was spawned from a tour bus argument about whether Slug or Murs had a better chance of getting with the actress, who was then between her marriages to Lenny Kravitz and Jason Momoa. This second album was produced by Slug's groupmate, Anne. They continued the theme of focusing on actresses they had thought slipped from the spotlight on 2009's Felt 3, a tribute to Rosie Perez. This third record was produced entirely by Aesop Rock. They also name-dropped celebrities throughout track titles, including Suzanne Vega, Rick James, Morris Day, Marvin Gaye, Kevin Spacey, and Paul Rubens. Rumor has it there's a stage play being worked on based off their records, and if you haven't heard them, you should go track them down.
What do you remember about those sessions?
Those sessions, I was feeling a lot of pressure because those guys kind of sprung it on me last minute. They're like, we're doing a project together and we want you to produce it. And we're going to be, you know, Slug's going to be in LA in a couple days. And,
and I was have like, 12 songs ready or whatever. Yeah.
But they were like, do you want to do it? And I'm like, oh, of course, you know? And Merce was probably like, you know, you get your beats together. Yeah. You know, do you have beats? And I'm like, yeah, you know, and I remember not having that many like in the stockpile at that point. So yeah, I was in the studio every day and I was making beats and they'd come in and they'd say, you know, I'd make like four or five beats and they'd say, all right, we want that one. We don't like the other ones, or, you know, we want those two. And then they would record, they write really fast and record really fast. So they record them that day and write them. And then they'd go home and then I'd have to make a whole nother pile of beats for the next day. And so I was doing that every day at that time. And, you know, it was just kind of, it was fun. It was like being pushed to come up with beats like real fast on the spot. And, you know, that's how it happened.
Oh, and so what are each of you guys up to now? I know you released a whopping triple album back in middle of 2014. And Eli, you've done stuff. You did a song with that group AES, the one that incorporates like classical Indian instruments and stuff. What are each of you up to now?
Well, after the triple album, which was, man, we were really proud of that album, and it's so much music. It's like that thing is going to be living for a while to me before, you know, it's fully absorbed. But so that came out, and then I had already started a solo project called 80 Hertz, which I did with my friend DNA Beats.
Though one day the ways will be written by the most creative people on the planet. They've been underground and in the sense they always in the minute. If you see a person like myself emerging independent, then you better make a move to make a point and make a man blow up. So what? Make it through the 808.
So I finished that. I put that out. And that's what I'm working on right now is AES, the project with my friends that play classical Indian style music.
Consequence to never dance is this. You gotta move the spirit to get the people to near it. I fear it not. Never been afraid. The personality is brave. You can never catch me or put me in a cave. I will never be the one to bury in the grave. Put me in a rocket ship and put me in the space. Music is the way to God. I would like to think I'm odd. heady like a nigga vibe. I'm a thinker man, I think a lot. Many.
In the project that we made, we're almost done with the 15 songs, and I'm really, 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 really excited about it. My heart is fully in it. I believe so much in the music and the message, and, you know, once again, doing something different that inspires me personally, because in the end, I feel like for me, at least, it's, I do the music for me first. Like, it's for my personal enjoyment. It's a selfish thing almost. Like, it's, I love what I do, especially in the studio. Like, creating is the peak, and then there's everything that comes after, and there's the performance and all that stuff. So on a personal level, this has really filled me up, working with these guys, because it's something that I've never done before, and this music sounds like nothing I've ever made before. And so I'm fully invested in that, and just trying to give that music the best light and the widest audience possible.
Okay, and Grouch?
I'm working on music. I have a couple songs that I'm starting to, that are starting to take form that I like. We've done a little bit of some Zioni, Grouch, Eli tracks. I am learning to work Ableton this year. Just got some new equipment, and I've stayed away from that program, but I feel like it's time that I figure that one out. And I'm just, you know, taking it slow and seeing what comes naturally.
Excellent. And finally, Grouch, I know definitely you and maybe Eli, you were there as well, lived for a while in a giant warehouse with like 9 or 10 other rappers. What was the craziest thing that happened while you were there?
Oh God, I have one. I have a story. It was, well, I mean, the guys that lived in this particular warehouse, there was, you know, it was like a big building full of warehouses, and a couple doors down, we had more friends that lived there, but it was all the us Living Legends guys that lived in the warehouse together. And there was one crazy night where somebody came over with a pillowcase size bag of mushrooms.
And I was going to tell the same story.
Yeah, dude. I mean, it was one of the craziest nights we have ever seen in our life. Like, I'm a pillow size, dropped it on the floor. It was like, what's up, guys? And, you know, everybody starts eating mushrooms. And so, you know, long story short, someone ended up in the washing machine thinking they're a newborn baby and like
naked
and,
yeah.
And naked, sorry, completely naked, and people trying to like help this dude. It was madness. It was like a movie. And I'll never forget that night. I mean, there was a lot of crazy shit that happened and magical shit that happened in that warehouse, but that was probably one of the craziest nights ever.
Amazing. That seems like a great note to end on. Thank you. Thank you so much, guys.
No problem.
Thank you.
One of the things I loved about this interview was hearing about when Eli, the Grouch, and the rest of the crew were selling tapes hand to hand. It's pretty amazing to think that a few teenagers making music on a 4-track and trying to get people walking by to give them $5 for it actually led to long-term careers in rap. All the more so when you figure in the absolutely haphazard way they used to handle touring. One of the hallmarks of the music of Eli and the Grouch, both separately and together, is their honesty. You really hear that in this interview. They're candid about everything from substance abuse and family issues to which tempos they prefer to rap to. And after a career's worth of ever-changing music, it's good to know they both have plenty of new ideas and tricks left up their sleeve, as you heard toward the end of our talk. Join us next week when our guest will be Adrian Miller. In addition to managing one of the hottest artists in music right now, Anderson .Paak, Adrian has a long history in the rap business. He's helped to discover acts like The Far Side, Coolio, Freestyle Fellowship, Funk Dubious, and tons more. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
And I would sit in there and hotbox that room.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
The guy on the corner with baggy pants and a certain kind of belt on, chewing on a licorice stick.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Motherfucker, check out this tape.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Look at this cool artwork I did. I think you should buy this because it's really cool.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
Always had big speakers in our house that on Saturday and Sunday would be blasting. She used to play stuff really loud.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Scott Limbacher.
He started being a cool dude and making some creative things. I was like, oh, yeah. This guy's dope.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
You know, I was thinking about doing a new project on a 4-track for sure.